Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest is A.K. Turner, who's a TV producer and writer whose first foray into crime fiction was a detective thriller trilogy written under the pen name Anya Lipska. Her latest novel, Body Language, is about Camden mortuary assistant Cassie, who thinks she has seen it all until she comes face to face with someone she knows on the slab in front of her. Back with us on the book show is Graham Slater, who spent several years playing Hammond organ in various groups in the 60s, where he played with Jimi Hendrix, Elton John, James Taylor and Fats Domino. More recently, he's been speaking about creative writing on cruise ships. His eighth novel, I Will Survive, is set in Amsterdam, with much of the action taking place in a bar and brothel called Love Shack. Also with us is Terence Gallagher, who splits his time between Florida and Dublin. He's worked as a management consultant in England, Ireland, the US, France and the Philippines. His debut novel, Analyst Session, is an intelligent and fast-paced thriller. It's set against a backdrop of 1980s England, when the spectacular failure of an IT project enables a clever fraud that goes undetected for a decade. And finally tonight, we're chatting to Ken Scott, a local author, ghostwriter and book coach who has written or collaborated on 32 books, of which several have reached the Sunday Times bestseller list. He's held the number one bestseller spot on Amazon with six of his ghost-written books and even has a movie optioned in Hollywood for his best-selling Do the Birds Still Sing in Hell? That's tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
I am unwritten, can't read my mind, I'm undefined. I'm just beginning, the pen's in my hand. Before you open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Treat yourself. Words unspoken, live your life with arms wide open. Today is where your book begins.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Alison Turner, or A.K. Turner, whose first foray into crime fiction was a detective thriller trilogy written under the pen name Anya Lipska. All three books won critical acclaim and were twice optioned as a possible TV series. In her other life as a TV producer and writer, she makes documentaries and drama documentaries on subjects as diverse as the mutiny on the Bounty, the sex lives of Neanderthals and Monty Don's Italian Gardens. But she's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel. It's called Body Language, and in it we meet Cassie Raven, who's a goth, a Londoner and a mortuary assistant. Welcome to the book show, Alison.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you with us, and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you. Yeah, it's very exciting to have a new one out.
Yes, it looks great. I love the front cover with all the scissors.
Yeah.
Do you have any say in the front cover? Do you work with others doing it? Or
a little bit of a say, yes. I mean, it would be very rare that an author would turn around and say, I absolutely hate the cover, go back to the drawing board, and the publisher would probably not agree. But I had a little bit of input about, you know, size of type and stuff like that. at the minute I saw the image, I went, this is absolutely beautiful, the colours, the, you know, the scissors, as you say, the hint of spooky. It's great. I love it.
Yeah. So why are you writing this book under A.K. Turner? Who's Anya Lipska? Tell us the background of your names.
Well, yeah, my name is Alison Turner. My first trilogy was about a Polish detective in East London, and it was really a decision to have a more sort of Polish name, really. At the time, I was married to a Polish guy, so I had an excuse. So I used a Polish sounding name for that. And with this book, I'm returning to my real name, as it were. Although the middle initial is not mine.
Made up the K.
Yeah, it's a publisher decision, some of these things.
Why not? So tell us about the character of Cassie Raven.
Yeah, so Cassie is a bit of a goth, you know. She's got sort of dyed black hair, shaved undercut. She's got facial piercings and tattoos. So she's a sort of challenging-looking gal. She works in a mortuary in inner-city Camden. But Cassie is a very layered personality. She's very complicated, and she's very, despite her challenging appearance, she's got a real love and respect for the dead bodies with which she works, and feels she has a real affinity with them, treats them as though they're people, gives them the respect and dignity they deserve. She almost sees herself as a sort of priestess of the last bit of their journey out of this world and into whatever comes after. And so she believes that she can sometimes feel or hear or sense something about how they died, that they... She talks to them sort of routinely, but sometimes they answer her. And I should hasten to add that it's not a supernatural book. We can equally read into this that she's actually super observational. She's a bit of a Sherlock of the mortuary. Mm. And she picks up things that could otherwise be missed. And then perhaps, you know, that's where she gets these messages, if you like, from. Because I think what people don't, if that sounds a bit sort of, well, how would she pick up things the pathologist doesn't? I've spent 3 years researching this book, and I can tell you even pathologists say that mortuary technicians, to give them their proper name, anatomical pathology technicians, they spend far longer with the body, far longer with the medical notes. They have connections, they communicate with the family, and they actually do the evisceration of the body, that is the cutting open of the body and the removal of the organs, before the pathologist even gets involved. So I think people don't perhaps always realize that. It's different with a forensic post-mortem where there's been a crime, but when it's just a body turns up in the mortuary and it's going to get a routine post-mortem, the pathologist will only get maybe half an hour to do his part of the process.
Mm, interesting. I didn't really understand the job of a mortuary technician, that they had to do all of that.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, this was... I went to a post-mortem for my first book, excuse me, and I was really kind of astonished by that. I knew what the pathologist did and all that was fascinating, but there was this mortuary technician there who was a bit of a goth and a bit of a character she was, and I was just astonished how much they did. You know, they need a lot of training for it. And yeah, as I say, they do all the stuff with the body, and they will do that to thousands of bodies over a 5-year period. Cassie's been in her mortuary for 5 years. They'll deal with thousands of bodies. So of course they're going to pick up things that might otherwise get missed.
Weird job, though. It's really hard to, I mean, each to their own, but it's hard to imagine going to work and doing a job like that and then going home and saying, right, what does everyone want for tea? And
absolutely. Know,
very
it?
Strange.
I mean, just being in a mortuary for an hour was, you know, I didn't, I remember this gal I was talking about, the gothy one, she said, look, if you're going to faint or vomit, can you just let me know ahead of time? And I was very proud of myself that I did neither. But yeah, it's a pretty tough experience if you're a civilian, as they call us. But, you know, you get used to it. And if you have a fascination with anatomy, which they obviously do have to have, then my key mortuary technician, who's a wonderful woman called Barbara Peters, who's won lots of awards, she's been in the business for years and years and years, she says that what happens is that when you treat them as, you know, humans, people, whatever, up to a point, when they arrive in the mortuary, she treats her bodies with great respect, of course. And then when you have to cut them open, you've got to turn off. You've got to go into a different mode and see it, you know, distance yourself in some way from that being a person.
Yeah, and definitely.
And then you do that, and then you reconstitute them and put the organs back in and sew them back up, and then it's, okay, they're back to being a person.
Wow, yes, there's a sort of sciencey bit in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely, where you've got to be, yeah, cold and analytical.
Yeah, interesting. And with regards to this book then, you say you did years and years of research for it. Before you started doing the research, how much of the story had you already established, other than the fact that you knew your main character was going to be a mortuary technician?
I had the bare bones of it. I had the bare bones of it, that somebody, there's sort of two plots really going on. One is a body that disappears from the mortuary, and the other one is someone turns up in the mortuary on Cassie's, you know, Cassie opens a body bag and finds someone that she loved there, and nonetheless insists on doing the evisceration, as it's called. And from that, you know, developed sort of queries about how this person died and was it natural, and goes off sleuthing. So I had all that, and then of course plots develop as you write them, and the research sort of, it's not you don't really sort of do the plot and then do the research, it all happens together. So I would go out and spend an evening with Barbara talking about, you know, taking people's brains out in a pub and getting funny looks. you know, she would tell me something that would happen. I'd go, like, oh, that'd be fantastic for, you know, the next chapter that's coming up. Or I'm going to slightly alter the plot to ensure I get that right. Because I've got a journalistic background, it's really, really important to me to get as much as I possibly can right. There's, of course, always artistic license, especially in terms of the timings of things. You know, you want to fit it into the timing of a book and not say 3 months later they got the results of the whatever back. So there is artistic license, but I get as much as I possibly can factually correct.
And what you said about the fact that a body turns up on her table who she knows and loved, that must be a whole different ball game for her to carry on doing her job in that situation. That must be really tough.
Of course, but again, in the book I have her, you know, really struggling a bit with that, but the minute she makes that initial incision, she has her professionalism, her automatic kicks in.
And she starts to go down her own route of researching what possibly could have happened to this person.
That's right, yeah. She sort of turns sleuth and she's suspicious of someone close to this person and, follows that up, tries to interest the police, because the second character is Detective Sergeant Phyllida Flight, who's an uptight detective who's just moved to Camden from leafy Winchester because she's had a traumatic divorce. And Cassie tries to interest her in following this up. And at the same time, the cop is suspicious of Cassie about this missing, there's a body missing from the mortuary, and she looks at her and goes, like, oh, she's a goth, she's, you know, got piercings, she's a weirdo, she's suspicious of her. So there's a sort of real antagonism between the two of them at the beginning, but eventually they sort of have an uneasy truce because Flight, the detective, realizes there is something amiss about this death.
Interesting stuff. So is this going to be a standalone or could it turn into a series, do you think?
No, it's a series. It's a two-book deal in the UK, and I'm very happy to say it's been sold in Germany, France, Russia, Ukraine, all sorts of places. So, yeah, it looks like it has a bit of a future.
Fantastic. So have you already got ideas for the second book? Is it all planned out? Have you started writing it?
Oh, yeah. I'm halfway through it, yeah.
Ah, brilliant.
Yeah, they don't give you much time off for good behaviour.
No. Well, in the meantime, before the next one comes out, we've got Body Language available to buy on our website, tre.radio. It's by Alison Turner, or A.K. Turner, as it says on the book, who we've been chatting to today. Alison, thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK, back on the book show, is Graham Slater. He studied at the Phoenix Arts Centre in Exeter, where he concentrated on creative writing for the screen and television. He spent several years playing Hammond organ in various groups in Germany and Scandinavia during the 60s, where he played with Jimi Hendrix and Elton John. He returned to England in the late 60s, where he worked with James Taylor, toured with Europe and Fats Domino. More recently, Graham's been engaged to speak about creative writing on cruise ships, and Write On was launched in June last year. He's back with us on the book show to talk about his eighth novel, I Will Survive. Welcome to the book show, Graham.
Hello, Hannah. Nice to be with you again. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago maybe we spoke last, but
yes.
It's always great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. It's lovely to chat with you again as well. And what an eventful year it's been, hasn't it?
Oh, it's been strange. I mean, from my point of view, I mean, I managed to finish I Will Survive, but we also had, I was booked for 4 cruises this year.
Oh.
And none of them happened. But the last one we had was Christmas and New Year, which was wonderful. And that was 21 days. So we're spoiled over Christmas, New Year. And I think, I keep saying to my wife, if we hadn't had that one, I think we'd been really fed up now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's been a long time for many people not going on holiday and things. So looking at the writing then, I know we spoke before a few years ago, but for anyone who didn't hear our chats, just to sort of tell them about a bit about your history in terms of music, because as I mentioned in the introduction, you've played with some amazing people. It must have been a great time.
Well, it was. I mean, my career started when I was 16, and I went to Germany with a group that was put together by a singer who needed 5 people to go to Germany. And back then, you either had to have an organist, which is what I was, or a girl singer. Well, he was the singer, so he wouldn't want the girl. So he literally knocked on my front door and said, look, you play the organ. I've got an audition in London next week. Will you come with us? And we spent probably most of that week rehearsing just rock and roll songs, really, because we believed incorrectly that Germany, it was just rock and roll that they wanted. But of course, when we eventually got there, which was January 64, we found that they knew the records that we were playing back at home. So we had a major rethink, which was a bit of a shock for us to relearn and learn lots of new songs with a lot more chords than we've been playing.
Yeah. And what about when you played with some big stars, the likes of Jimi Hendrix, Elton John? What was that like?
Brilliant. I mean, that was slightly later in the 60s. I mean, I was in Hamburg, Germany, for nearly 5 years, predominantly Hamburg, but I did tour around Germany. And I played with Jimi Hendrix in Sweden in September 67. And I was in, we were in the band I was in. It's my third band since I'd gone to Germany. And we were there, we were in Gothenburg for about 3 weeks. And we toured around Sweden, staying at other hotels. But we were in Gothenburg for about 3 weeks. And the weekend we were there, they changed the side of the road that they drove on. And we had a gig across Gothenburg, and we weren't allowed to turn the engine on. So we pushed our van across the city. And when we got back to our hotel, we all piled into the little bar in the basement. And in walked Jimi Hendrix with Chas Chandler and Mitch Mitchell, his drummer. And I asked him if he would get up and jam with us. So we brought all the gear in, and we jammed. And it was absolutely fantastic for a couple of hours, you know. Wonderful.
Oh, wonderful stuff. And how about going on tour with Europe and Fats Domino and things? How did that come about?
Well, Fats Domino, a friend of mine, was putting together the tour. I saw Fats Domino at the Hammersmith Odeon the year before. I went backstage with a friend of mine who promoted Fats Domino. He brought him over from New Orleans. And he called me up and he said, look, we're doing a 6-week tour. Do you want to come on it? And I said, yeah. So we did 6 weeks. We had one night off, which was in Vienna. And, oh, it was fantastic. I mean, it was the best sort of gig I'd ever had, to be honest, because we had roadies, the lights, the PA, luxury coach, five-star hotels. It was just wonderful. Fats, at the time, when he first arrived, he wasn't well, to be honest. He was on a lot of drugs. His cousin was with him, who was giving him uppers and downers to get him out of bed and get him on stage. But after spending a week with him, he used to get in the coach and sit in the back with me because I've recorded one of his songs, Hello Josephine, which was a hit in Spain, actually, in 1979 with a group called Shades. And we did a big pop show over there. And we also played in the Madrid Music Hall. And that was 79. So he loved that. And he signed a couple of the records for me, which I've still got. But it was... But after a week, he actually improved and he got better and cut back on a lot of the tablets that he was taking and absolutely loved it. My big upset really was we should have played at the Odeon Hammersmith, but because the guitarist died in Amsterdam from a heroin overdose, the promoter decided that we'd cut the tour short and to keep everyone in Holland for 2 or 3 days, then fly everyone back into London, the cost was much higher than the money he would have earned, in the Hammersmith Odeon, so they cancelled the date. Mm. So he then flew back with everyone else to New Orleans. So it was a bit of a sad time, but I'm pleased to have done it, and doing the TV show was great. I've found it on YouTube. I'll send it to you if you want.
Oh,
you
yes, please.
Have a look. but it was a great show. We had hired our own plane to fly out and do the show. And it was just wonderful, just wonderful. We had a hit album and a hit single over there with a group called Shades, a rock and roll band. So I will send you the video. And on it, you'll see me miming saxophone and guitar. because one of the guys dropped out. He was afraid of flying. So we get over there and they said, well, we've got to have four people on the television. So I ended up miming the saxophone and guitar.
Brilliant. Brilliant. So I can't believe that this is your eighth novel now. So when did you start writing? What made you decide to write a book?
Well, I was writing scripts and I had a bit of success, which unfortunately, like a lot of things in life, didn't materialise. I was writing, I wrote a TV series and Adam Faith, who's no longer with us, set up a production company with one of the guys from Chrysalis to actually make the series, and it was called Buskers. And I had lunch with Adam and we worked it all out. I wrote 6 episodes, it was all ready to go, and he died. And then I had an option with Central Television to do a series which was going to be based on my time in Hamburg. And again, they paid quite a large advance to me, but Central was taken over by ITV proper and they decided not to go ahead with it. So those two things, and I was so disappointed with that because, you know, I really thought, well, they were going to happen, you know. So I thought, look, I write novels, and I started writing. So the idea that was going to be the TV series, which was Ticket to Ride, I decided to then sit down, rethink it, and good and bad happened again to me. I developed kidney cancer and had to have my kidney out. And so I was, you know, spent 3 months really unable to do very much at all. I mean, I couldn't believe how bad it was. I had a Zimmer frame for a while, which is quite frightening. But that was in 2004. I'm still here. And during that time, I actually, you know, spent it really thinking about and trying to remember things that happened to me and things I saw back in Germany. And then I decided to write it as a novel. I call it Faction because everything in it happened, but not necessarily to me. And so I spent the 3 months really going back in my mind. And it's incredible when you actually start thinking how much actually comes back. Mm. So I wrote that novel, and that was published in 2006. So really 2004 writing novels, to be honest. And I like you say, I can't believe I've written 8. it just seems incredible because I didn't think I could write one, leave alone 8.
And does it get any easier?
No. I've just started working on the new one, which is called Street Life, and it's about buskers. in an imaginary city in the West Country. And every time you start, you do wonder, am I able to finish it? Will I actually finish it? You know, and you almost shake when you start sitting down at the computer and looking at the blank screen. You type the heading first, and then you look at it and you think, you know, you shake. You think, am I gonna get to write this? You know, will I finish it? And it doesn't get any easier at all. In fact, it's harder because you know you've done it, but you know as you've written more and more, you realise how hard it is.
Yeah.
Even with all the planning that you do, you just it's not just sit down and knock it out. You just can't do that.
Mm. I love how you get the music theme in all the books with the song titles and things. Very clever.
Well, it's something I spend a lot of time with, and I carry notebooks everywhere I go. And I Will Survive is the title deliberately for that novel. The next one, Street Life, of course. The lyrics to Street Life actually fit. You know, I live on the streets for a dollar or a dime. You know, Street Life is the only place I know.
Yeah.
And I think that fits in exactly with what buskers go through. And I play the piano accordion, and I have already been out doing a bit of busking just to see what it feels like, and I don't like it.
Oh, really? Well, what, you tried that recently?
Yeah, well, I tried it before March, before the lockdown,
yes,
actually.
When you were allowed to.
Because, well, that's right. And I went out for a couple of Saturdays in Exeter here, and I played my accordion. I have to read music now, which is a little bit difficult if it's windy because...
Oh, gosh,
you know, you
yes.
have to peg them onto the music stand. But, no, I didn't like it. I think I got about 50p. And it really wasn't worth the effort because I had to, you know, replay and relearn everything. But no, I do research everything I write. I spend a lot of time researching, and the song titles, they actually come to me. I mean, for some chapters, I might have two or three titles that I want to use. But as I've when I finish the book and I go through and read each chapter, you know, obviously you're doing that, but I read the chapter and then I decide which is the best song to give to that chapter, and hopefully it gives a clue to what's coming in the chapter. But people don't twig that, but I know it because I obviously know what's coming, so I know that it fits. But it's something I like to do. I've done it in every book apart from the historical book, Hatred is the Key, because that was 200 years ago, and I didn't really want to use old English songs and things.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't have worked, you know, it's pointless. So, but every other book, every chapter, and the titles really are songs. I spend a lot of time thinking about that.
And there's also things in the book. So with this new book, one of the main characters, Liam, is running a bar called Love Shack, which, of course, is also a song title.
Well, it was my fifth or sixth book, and it sort of follows on. I mean, I've done a few interviews and people that have read it, and they said, "Well, we read Love Shack, you know, do we want to read I Will Survive?" And I said, "Well, they're both standalone novels. The characters are consistent, some of them, not all, and it works, but." Yeah, Love Shack was the first one in that series, I suppose, if it is a series, and I just like the characters. And when I was cruising last year, people said to me, "Oh, you've never written about a cruise." Because they buy my books on the ships. They say, you've never written anything about cruises. So it gave me an idea to write, not a sequel or follow-up, but to write another book using those characters and then incorporating the cruise idea to get them from A to B invisibly, because I didn't want them flying anywhere because everything is tracked, you see. So I thought if they're on a cruise ship, they literally get off, and as long as you walk off the ship and put your little card through the machine and back on, no one knows what you've done whilst you've been on land.
Yeah.
So it gave me the idea the plot and the way of following the book through, really, the story through.
And you could have the title Cruisin', which, of course, is a song.
Well, could well have done, but again, you see, cruising, five, 6 years ago, if you'd have said to me, "Graham, you know, talk Radio Europe, you've just won a prize, you've got a free cruise," I would have said, "Don't really want to do it. Can I have the money or half of it or whatever?" But when I did the first one with my grandson, which was to the fjords, I loved it. And, of course, I came back and I told my wife I loved it. She didn't believe me. And my grandson said, "Yeah, we loved it, we loved it." So the next one we did, and the first one we did together, was to St. Petersburg and to Tallinn. And
oh, wonderful.
right up in the boat, and it was wonderful. So, you know, we've got the bug for it. But as I say, it's disappointing we haven't done any this year. But hopefully next year, June time, I think they're going to start going again, you know.
Great. Well, in the meantime, if people want to get a copy of I Will Survive, it's available on our website, tre.radio. It's by Graham Slater, who we've been chatting to. Graham, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Hannah. Nice to talk to you.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Terence Gallagher, who splits his time between Florida and Dublin. He worked as a management consultant in England, Ireland, the US, France and the Philippines. He's now a writer, keen cyclist and reluctant gardener. He's with us on the Book Show to talk about his debut novel, Analyst Session. What would you do for love, it asks. It's an intelligent and fast-paced thriller set against a backdrop of England in the 1980s, when the spectacular failure of an IT project enables a clever fraud that goes undetected for a decade. Welcome to the Book Show, Terence.
Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you for joining us. So tell me, how long have you been working on this book for? Where did you get the idea from? Can you remember?
The book actually started, must be over 25 years ago. And I got the idea because I worked in London for 3 years, just after I graduated college. One of my clients was an electricity board. It was working in that environment and working with large IT projects that gave me the idea to come up with a kind of a crime thriller.
And had you written anything before? What made you think this would make a good book and I'm going to write it?
No, I hadn't written anything before. It was just that I found it interesting to see how large IT projects can sometimes take on a life of their own. That, some of the favorite ideas are, you know, big projects start out with enthusiasm and optimism, and then there's a realization begins to set in. That things aren't going so well, and it's the notion of, you know, the search for the guilty and the punishment of the innocent, and then reward for everybody who wasn't involved in the project.
Yeah,
so that's kind of the.
So, can you give us an example when you say a big IT project? What sort of thing do you mean that you used to be involved in?
Not projects that I was personally involved in, but there were certainly enough instances. I think about 10 years later, there was a big IT project related to the National Health Service in England, which famously went wrong. And huge sums of money were poured in by the UK government to this system, which never seemed to go right. In the end, I think the whole thing was scrapped. So there are plenty of instances of very large projects that start out with great intentions and they don't work out. Mm. I mean, even today, we had the test and trace system for COVID tracing. That's only in the last few months, and there's been all this coverage of how it hasn't worked so well. So, you know, some things haven't changed.
Yes. And with regards to the writing of the book, how did you find that? How did you decide your method, if you like, having not done it before?
Well, the first effort with the book was done, 25 years ago. And I was essentially a senior executive, and I was given a posting to a client about 30 miles, 40 miles from where I lived. And so I would have to commute backwards and forwards every day. So I decided I might as well use the time productively. So I had a little tape recorder. I would tape passages of the book, and then I would have someone type it for me. So that was how it was done. And then I revisited it recently and edited it and re-edited it and then just had it published.
And the way that you work, did it work for you? Are you writing the next book the same way?
Oh, no. The technology has changed considerably. First of all, you know, I'm I'm now retired from IT, so I have a lot more time. And there's much more technology that's available. So there are tools like Scrivener that allow you to, you know, to build the framework of your book and all of that. And then you have software packages like Grammarly, which will do some basic grammar checking for you. So it's just a whole different technology that you can use to help you write, which wasn't available 25 years ago.
No. So looking at the book, then, Analyst Session, tell us about your main character, Andrew Sweeney.
Well, Andrew Sweeney, some of it is autobiographical in the sense that he's Irish, and he went to Trinity College Dublin, and he's a computer analyst. So, you know, I drew on some of my upbringing and my background to, you know, flesh out the characteristics of this individual. And then some of it is a flight of fancy, you know, in terms of how he behaves and who he marries and all of that. So that's fictional. But a fair amount of the Irish Catholic guilt and those aspects of it, they would be drawn from my upbringing and my background.
Interesting. And was that a sort of conscious thing? Did you purposely want to have some of yourself in that character?
I think so, yes. I think for my first book or for my first character, I mean, they say, you know, write about what you know. So I kind of wrote about, you know, myself and how I would react given my upbringing and my, you know, my moral beliefs and so on in a given situation. Though, you know, I would like to think that I haven't broken the law anytime recently or previously.
Yes. So without giving too much away, obviously, can you tell us a bit about what happens in the book?
Well, what happens in the book is that Andrew marries the love of his life, but discovers that she has expensive habits and expensive tastes, and his modest salary just doesn't seem to be able to keep up. And then an opportunity arises because he finds himself in a position where he is able to program fraud within the billing system of an electricity company. He does that in a somewhat clever way, and because he isn't spectacularly greedy, he's able to siphon off what turns out to be a quite decent amount of money every year, which he can divert to help pay for the lifestyle. And that goes on for a lot of years until the decision is made, you know, by a new incoming head of the company to revamp the billing system. And then circumstances arise so that the fraud is uncovered. Mm-hmm. And then what is he going to do about that, right? Because his what drives him is the fear of losing the love of his life, the fear that if he can't maintain the lifestyle for his wife, she will leave him.
And did you want to continue with these characters? Will future books feature some of the same characters, or is it definitely a standalone?
It's a standalone, and I think when I write, I tend to write a complete piece. At least that's the way I think. I write a complete piece. I tell a story, and then that's that. I move on and create a new world and new characters.
Fair enough. And can you tell us anything about your later book?
I can tell you about the book I'm working on now, mm-hmm. which is called A Coup in Makati. And Makati is the business district of Manila. And in December of 1989, there was a coup against the president, Corazon Aquino. And for a week, a group of Western businessmen were trapped in the Peninsula Hotel by the rebels, with gunfire going on all over the place. And so this novel is a fictional account of a group of these businessmen who find themselves in this situation, and how it all plays out against this political background. So the week is real, December 1989, and the events, a lot of the events are real, but the characters I create are fictional.
Yes. Yes, brilliant. Well, if people want to get a copy of Analyst Session, it's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Terence Gallagher, who we've been chatting to today. Terence, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Hannah. It's been a pleasure.
This is Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Ken Scott. He's an author, a ghostwriter, and a book coach based on the Costa Blanca. He's written or collaborated on 32 books, several of which have reached the Sunday Times top 10 bestseller list. He also worked alongside Debbie Twelves, who was a recent guest on the book show, talking about her incredible story. The book was called 20 Years a Stranger. Welcome to the book show, Ken.
Hi, Hannah. How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
Good, good, good. I'm out in the sunshine at the moment, so
oh,
I hope you don't get too much of a background noise. There may be an odd seagull flies by, but you'll just have to put up with it, I'm afraid.
That'll add some atmosphere. It'll be fine. So tell me, how did you get into writing? How did this all come about for you?
Well, how did I get into writing? It would be probably about 16 or 17 years ago now. And like everybody, you think there's a book in you. After work one evening, I decided that I had a little plot about a novel. I was working in financing and banking at the time, and I had a little fantasy to rob the bank from the inside. So that was my first novel, the first go to novel that was actually published. It's called The Jack of Hearts. And it was just, I suppose, a hobby more than anything. Really, really enjoyed what I was doing, the writing side of things. And I think after I completed the first book, obviously I wanted to do another one almost straight away. And I suppose that's how I fell into it. The ghostwriting was a little bit different. That came a few years later. And I was asked to write Dwayne Chambers' book. Dwayne Chambers was the sprinter, the black guy that was caught out on the old drugs, and he was banned from the Olympics. I don't know if you can remember.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I was asked by his agent, who'd read a couple of my books, if I could meet up with Dwayne and do his book, and it kind of all fell into place and started from there.
Yeah. So what was it like ghostwriting? I mean, I assume it's quite a different experience to writing your own book.
Yeah, but not an altogether different experience. It's different in the fact that you can't imagine, you can't use your own imagination, you can't dream plots up, and you can't dream characters. You're very much writing what somebody's telling you to write, and you're writing their story. But the research side of things, and that's very, very good and interesting. And yeah, it's a different experience, but not altogether that much different from writing your own book, to be perfectly honest.
Mm. So when you're ghostwriting for somebody else, are you kind of interviewing them and taking notes, and then you put it together in a story? Is that how it works?
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Yeah. And do you tend to record your voice and their voice, or do you take notes? How do you do it?
I did it first, but then I found myself referring to the recordings just to make sure you're not putting something in that hasn't been said. But I think predominantly, and certainly the last 4 or 5 years, I'm an old-fashioned pen and paper type of guy, and I just go from notebooks, you know?
Yeah, fair enough. And you've also held the number one bestseller spot on Amazon with 6 of your ghost-written books. That's brilliant.
Yeah, Amazon's not altogether too difficult to get a bestseller, to be perfectly honest. It just depends more or less on daily sales, and the push it together with an algorithm, and you know, you can get a bestseller if you sell a few thousand copies. The holy grail is the old Sunday Times top 10, And I've been fortunate enough to get in there three times. Four times because they relaunched one of my books only last year, and it made the top 10 list again. So that's the old holy grail. But it's good fun, and it's a little bit recognition. And once you get to these sort of bestseller stages, it's kind of justification for what you're doing, you know.
Mm. And one of your best-selling books, Do the Birds Still Sing in Hell? There's a movie been optioned in Hollywood for it. That's good.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's 7 years in the making now. The first option we assigned on it about 7 years ago. Now, funnily enough, I just got a phone call from the producers last month, and it should be all systems go for the spring. When they hope to start filming in the spring, they have the budget in place, they have the director in place. I haven't been told who he is yet, but he's a British guy apparently, and it's all system go. We're off to Eastern Europe, in Poland, in what, looking at March, April, to try and catch the last of the winter snow, because there's a lot of the scenes in the prisoner of war camp. The book's about a prisoner of war called Horace Greasley, and obviously a lot of the scenes was in winter and with the ones on the ground, so that's where we're heading. Hopefully the early spring next year, fingers crossed.
Oh yes, how exciting. And is that one of your books?
Yes, yeah, I wrote it for a guy was living in Spain, actually, in Alfaz. He's dead now, but he was 89-year-old when he decided he wanted to write his story, and I wrote it for him there. So, it's all good. That's also published in, I think, 11 languages now, so it's done tremendously well. I suppose, really, it was the book that kind of put me on the map, if you like, you know?
Mm. Wonderful. And you also do coaching as well. What's that like, coaching other people to write?
Well, I love that. Actually, it's very, very rewarding. It doesn't pay anywhere near the money that a ghostwriter could do. And obviously, it is their book, so they would they cop for the royalties and anything that comes their way at the end of the day. But I do really like that side of things, because I suppose you're doing a one-to-one writing course with somebody, and initially their writing's, I suppose, if I'm honest, fairly poor. And as each chapter goes by, you can see their personal growth, how they're learning things, how they're constructing sentences, developing characters, bringing a chapter together, begin, the middle, and an end, and ultimately at the end of the book, and then we'll go back and rewrite it again. But ultimately at the end of the book, you see the difference between, you know, the first chapter that they've submitted to the last chapter that's actually written. And one of the exercises I do, I always tell them to look at the final chapter, and then I send them the original first chapter that they sent me maybe 6, 7, 8 months ago, and there's just no comparison in it, and they can see it, and I can see it, and it's quite a rewarding experience. And fortunately as well, because I'm involved with such a lot of publishers now, all the books that I do take on, even from a coaching point of view, I guarantee them a publishing deal, which is good, you know. And so we'd see the finished article as well in print, and it's a nice part of the job, you know.
Mm, fantastic. And how do you decide which authors you're going to write with? Is it very much about the story that they've created?
Absolutely.
Or? Yeah.
Absolutely. It's the story every time. I mean, in the early days, you know, when I was struggling to try and make a living out of this game, I would more or less entertain anybody and try and help them with their stories, even though some of them bored me to tears. But now I'm in a very fortunate position where I cherry pick the stories, and if somebody hasn't got a story, then I don't really work with them. I shouldn't say that, but it really is as simple as a story. I have to see a potential bestseller, a potential movie. You know, the story has to be very, very good. Mm. And obviously they have to have the application and the commitment to go through with the project as well. So there's several factors involved in me deciding to work with somebody, whether it's on the coaching side or the ghostwriting side, there's several factors involved. And as I say, I'm a little bit picky these days.
Good for you.
But it all works out for the best, because when I'm throwing these stories at my publishers, the publishers now know that they are good stories and have got the potential to sell.
Yeah. And I guess each case must be different. Some people will need more help than others. And
yes,
and
so absolutely right. Yeah. Absolutely right. I mean, some people, you see the initial chapter that they send you and you think, my God, how am I going to turn this around? But again, that's part of the challenge. Other people send me chapters and they can write, and their English is a lot better than mine. but all they'll need is really a little bit guidance to structure the story correctly, or they need sometimes just to foot up the backside to meet the deadlines, you know. I mean, there's a couple of people I've worked with in the past where tremendous. I mean, one, for example, and you interviewed her a couple of months ago, Debbie Twelves is a terrific writer. She really is very, very good. I've got her on the book too already. I says, you have to try and make a living from this, because she's a very, very good writer. And a lot of my job with Debbie was the getting her into the deadlines, getting the chapters produced in time, and more just guidance. Debbie done all the writing, and it was more just guidance and telling her how to, as I say, construct a chapter, develop a character. Gave her a few pointers on the plots and how to leave chapters with a big tease at the end so that the reader wants to jump in the next chapter as soon as they can. So Debbie's was a very easy job because she's a very good writer. And as I say, she's a teacher, she's an English teacher, so her English is far better than mine. but then, as I say, there's the other people where, you know, you really, it's a big job. It's tough because, you know, the grasp of the English language isn't very good. I've also worked with two dyslexics in the past as well, and that can be tricky, you know. We'll get there, but it can be tricky, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting chatting with you. If listeners want to get in touch with you, if they want any help or advice or guidance in writing a book, what's the best way for them to reach you?
KenScottBooks.com is my website, and all the information's on there. KenScottBooks.com.
That's great. Ken, thank you so much for joining us. Lovely to chat with you.
Lovely speaking to you, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this programme, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.